since I got through, you know, only a fraction of what I wanted to do last time, I'm anxious to get through much more today. So I'm going to start right away, and stragglers will catch up as they can. So, yeah, thanks for coming back at all. It's always encouraging. What I'd like to talk about today are these topics. Possibly we won't get through all of them. I want to start with a quick recap, because as I was just discussing with Ian, there's a fair amount of new terminology that's already been introduced, and it's not a bad idea to revisit some of that quickly. In the course of that recap, just to sort of illustrate what we were doing last time, I want to show you a really cool example, which some of you have probably seen before, but I'm guessing not everybody has seen. It's a very cool example. Factitious, nothing, you know, real, it's whimsical, but it's actually a very useful, I guess as Daniel Dennett says, intuition pump. It just helps you wrap your head around what's going on. Then I want to talk, perhaps a little more technically than we've been doing, about the way this framework handles the concept of an event and the various structures that arise when you start looking at events. So more on that as we go. Then I want to talk about how this framework handles sequential measurement or sequential tests. And that also turns out to be very interesting. I don't know if we'll get there, but if there's time at the end, I want to begin talking, and we will continue next week to talk in any case, about how you linearize the framework. How you construct what we might call linear representations of probabilistic models. Before I get started, especially since more people have arrived, can I begin just by asking if there are any sort of questions right away that anybody has that, you know, left over from last time? Okay. And I also want to ask you guys a question, just a practical organizational question. Has everybody been able to access the notes online? Has that worked out? Okay, so if you do have any problems with that, let me know. Okay? All right, so let's start with a little bit of a recap. Last time, we were talking about probabilistic models, and the way I like to think about a probabilistic model is that it's a pair. A probabilistic model is a pair consisting of a collection of sets, what's called a test space, a collection of sets, I guess technically I should say a non-empty collection of non-empty sets, a hypergraph, we could also say, with the special interpretation that the elements of this collection are the complete outcome sets, the complete sets of mutually exclusive possible outcomes of various measurements or experiments or operations that you could perform, some catalog of available operations, or experiments, or tests, as we will say. The other component is a set, omega, of probability weights on this guy. So this is the state space. So that's a set of probability weights on script M. Maybe all of them, maybe some distinguished subset that you are particularly interested in, or that you think is you know, reflective of what's really going on. Okay, it's going to be useful at various points to start labeling probabilistic models sort of like this. I might want to say that the probabilistic model is, I don't know, like A, capital A is going to be basically a system label, all right? And so I might want to say system A is represented by this particular probabilistic model. And in order to keep track of what goes with what, I'll start using this sort of notation. I'll start writing M of A and omega of A and talking about the test space of system A, the state space of system A. Does that make sense to everybody so far? All right. We won't get into that sort of usage right away, but that's, you know, that's coming up a little later in the talk. Okay, so I promised you a whimsical and cool example. And so here it is. I want you to imagine the following, admittedly somewhat cruel, setup. I have a box. It's a triangular box. A top-down view of the box might look like this. Think of it as sort of an equilateral triangle. Now, this box has a very particular design. The interior of the box is partitioned into three chambers, like that. Okay, three chambers, which I'm going to call chamber one, chamber two, and chamber three. So far, so good? All right, now, I want you to further imagine that the top and the bottom of the box, so the top would cover everything, the bottom is, you know, the blackboard behind it, those are sealed. In fact, the whole box is sealed, but the top and the bottom are made of some completely opaque material. Can't be removed, can't be seen through. However, the sides of the box are made of some material that is maybe not perfectly transparent, but at least translucent. You can sort of get a cloudy view into the box from any side, okay? Now, inside the box, there is an insect, more specifically a firefly. Okay, so there's a firefly in the box. Now, that firefly might blink or it might not blink, yes? If you're looking, say, from down here, you know, if it blinks, you'll see a little faint glow over here to the right, and you'll know that the firefly is in chamber two. If it doesn't blink, everything is dark. You don't know where the firefly is. It could be anywhere, yes? Could even be blinking in chamber three, but you can't see chamber three. Well, why can't you see chamber three? Well, because these internal partitions prevent you from seeing through them. Now, I also want you to imagine that the firefly is free to move amongst the chambers. All right, so that presents a little problem right away if we want to implement this. We need these internal partitions to be some sort of membrane that's like a semi-permeable membrane. It's permeable to fireflies, but not to light. Well, actually, that's easy to arrange, right? You just make them thick enough that you can put little angled corridors through them, right? And the firefly can climb through, but light will not, you know, light goes in straight lines, so it won't go through. So that's easy. So the firefly can move from chamber to chamber, it can blink or it can fail to blink. Okay, now this gives me a test space. The test space consists of three possible experiments. I can basically look at the box from one of three sides. And incidentally, if you are the sort of person who immediately starts to think snarkily, well, I could look at it from a corner and sort of see, no, that won't work because the box is embedded in a building and there are you know, big concrete walls like this, and so you can't look. You can only go into viewing chamber, let's call this viewing chamber E, viewing chamber F, viewing chamber G, and in any viewing chamber you can only see through one side of the box, all right? So last time we talked a little bit about Grici diagrams. Let's see if we can make a Grici diagram for the resulting test space. Well, look at test E. There are at least two outcomes. I can see the firefly in chamber one, or I can see it in chamber two, but there is a third outcome, isn't there? I might not see any light at all. So no light, I'll just call that X. And so in my Ricci diagram, I'll just use the letters for the nodes, but you know, there you go, three outcomes, right? All right, now if I'm looking through from viewing room F, I could still see a light in chamber two. So that's an outcome. I could also see a light in chamber three, or I could see no light at all. But seeing no light at all from this perspective is not the same thing as seeing no light from this perspective. Because for instance, seeing no light from this perspective would be consistent with the firefly being in chamber three, but lit. But then I would see a light over here, whereas seeing no light from chamber F would be consistent with the firefly being in chamber one with its light on. So it's the no light outcome from chamber F means something different, and so we shouldn't use the same outcome. So I'll give it a different name. I'll call it Y. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay, and then of course, chamber G works the same way. You could see a light in chamber one, a light in chamber three, or you could see no light, but it's not the same thing as seeing no light from the other vantage points. So we have to give that a different letter. So we have three outcome tests, and they are, in some sense, just as sets, pasted together in that loop. Okay. Now, let's just abstract away from the labels for a moment. I'll just draw a regular old Ricci diagram here. So we've got this sort of a structure. And now the next thing that I want to do is I want to talk about what the possible probability weights are. So if this is my test space, I want to know what are the possible probability weights on M. Remember, PR of M is the set of all the probability weights. Well, we can kind of do this sort of by almost trial and error, just sort of by inspection. For instance, the firefly might in fact be in room one and with its light on, in which case I would see that outcome if I'm performing E or G. But if I'm performing F, I won't see anything, right? Because I can't see into chamber one from this side here. So I'll see this. I'll see this no light outcome. All right, does that make sense? If the firefly really is in chamber one with its light on, I will see this outcome for certain if I perform this measurement or this measurement, and this outcome for certain if I perform this measurement. Incidentally, this is kind of important. This is a deterministic zero or one, probability zero or probability one probability weight. We call a probability weight dispersion free. Or DF, or sometimes deterministic, if the value of alpha is, alpha being the probability weight, is either 0 or 1. Okay? Well, there are some other deterministic or dispersion-free states, right? We can just, you know, permute the position of the firefly. So we get this one, there's also this one and this one, yes. There's another dispersion-free probability weight. Can anybody see what it is besides those three?
If it's not lit?
Yes, if the firefly is not lit, then regardless of where it is, no matter which experiment I perform, I will see nothing. And so that weight looks like this, probability one, probability one, probability one. Okay, so I have these four deterministic probability weights. Incidentally, the set of probability weights as we observed last time is convex. It's a nice finite dimensional convex set. It's actually a polytope in this case. And like any polytope, it's got extreme points, vertices, which we would regard as pure probability weights. It's a little exercise, not hard, to show that dispersion-free implies pure or extreme. So just as a little aside, these four dispersion-free states would be, if we wanted to think of them as possible states of the firefly, thinking of the, you know, all the probability weights as potential states, then these would be pure states. I claim there's another pure state. Before I write it down, you see it? Okay, good. Okay, just checking. All right. Before I write that down, however, let me just observe that we can get lots more mixed states, right, by just taking weighted averages of these guys. Yes? All right. One thing to notice about a weighted average of the four dispersion-free states that we've just talked about is that we will always have a non-zero probability in any of those states to see one of these three sort of middle outcomes, right? This one assigns probability one to all three of those middle outcomes, and each of these assigns some non-zero probability to one of them. So no matter how I form a weighted average, I'm always going to have support that includes one of these three middle outcomes. Therefore, the following state cannot be a mixture of these four. It looks like this. Maybe at this point you can already see what it must look like. It's got to have its support on these three outcomes, probability zero for these. But of course, I can't give these probability one, because then that would add up to two along. Well, okay, no problem. I'll give them probability 1/2. That's a perfectly good probability weight. It adds up to one over each of the tests. And so the next question we should ask is, what does it mean? How could that arise? Can we tell a story about our unfortunate firefly trapped forever in this box that would account for that state? Anybody have any suggestions? Shall I just tell you? I can tell a story. Here's the standard story. The standard story about how this could possibly come about goes like this. The walls of this box are, after all, semi-transparent. They're translucent. Light goes both ways. Maybe the firefly can see you. And maybe the firefly is a happy, gregarious firefly. It likes people. So when it detects that you are, maybe it's flying around without its light on, and so it's going from chamber to chamber. But when it finds that, you know, there's somebody looking at it, it wants to say hello. So it blinks. And it's, you know, equally likely to be on either side. So there it is. That's the explanation. The firefly is coming to say hello. Okay, now that's kind of weird. If you've thought about things like this before, which I think many of you have done, you'd recognize that means that even though there's no hint of contextuality in this mathematical setup, the explanation is somehow contextual, right? Well, at any rate, we could go on about that for a long time. It's a really cool example because of the existence of that weird state.
Is it correct that it has no mixed states?
It has lots of mixed states. This state is pure. I haven't really proved that, although it's pretty clear that, I think at this point all the pure states are going to be this one or one of these four deterministic ones. The mixed states are just the weighted averages of these five. So for example, I could construct a state that said half the time there's no light and half the time the firefly wants to come and say hello. And so then the probabilities would be one half, one half, one half, one quarter, one quarter, one quarter.
Sorry, yes. If you take out the middle bits, if you say that you can't have the
So you're asking about a slightly different test space, but yes, in this is also kind of an instructive test space. There are three two-outcome experiments pasted together in a little triangle. In that case, this is the only possible assignment of a state. There is one and only one state, and of course, you know, it's pure sort of by default. Which answers one of the questions in the notes. Find a test space with only one state. There it is. Okay. Yes, go ahead.
Why you added this state? Why you want to add this pure state?
I didn't say that I wanted to add it. I'm saying that it's there mathematically.
Yeah, but why you cannot reason on a constrained space? Like
you can.
Just don't think about
yes,
it.
Yes, you can. And that is why our probabilistic models have two components. I want the freedom to constrain the state space.
Yes.
And so, yes, this is not a picture of a probabilistic model yet. Or if it is, it's tacitly a picture of the full, to use it jargon from last time, the full probabilistic model, where I just declare that every possible probability weight is a legitimate state. But there are lots of other models. I could ignore that, say, no, the states are these four deterministic states and weighted averages of those, that's my state space. That's fine, that's a different model. Right? And that's reasonable because in the one case you have a firefly that is oblivious to you. In the other case, if you do add that, you have a firefly that knows where you are. Ian's suggestion is yet another model. The firefly is in fact always in this gregarious state. Right? That's a perfectly good probabilistic model. You have three experiments, one possible probability weight. Okay? Yes, Lucian.
What happens if the firefly is only gregarious for if you're viewing from chamber E, anti-gregarious, whatever.
Right. In that case, what you're going to find, I don't want to work this out in detail now, but this is a great question. There are other stories we could tell about the firefly, and Lucian's is one, right? It likes people looking at it from chamber E. Chamber F and chamber G, it doesn't care. No matter how you try to assign those probabilities, following that story, you're going to find that the probability of getting an outcome in chamber two or in chamber one is different when you're performing experiment E than when you're performing experiment F or G. And that means that the probabilities are going to have to be genuinely contextual. And that means that this is the wrong test space.
So that Greachy diagram becomes wrong.
So the Greachy diagram becomes wrong. It's only reasonable to identify outcomes when you really think that, you know, it doesn't matter how you got them.
Okay.
And in particular, the probabilities must be the same. And that's another reason, perhaps, to distrust this gregarious firefly example. It's the one story like that that's consistent with these outcome identifications, and none of the others are. Okay, there's another story to tell about contextuality and how to handle it, but I want to save that for another time. Okay? So this was a lengthy recap and further discussion, but I think it was probably worthwhile. Let me keep at least one version of this Greachy diagram on the board because I will use it to illustrate our next topic. In classical probability theory, one defines not only outcomes, but events. And in a discrete case where, you know, let's say suppose I'm rolling two dice, and I'm just looking at which pairs of outcomes I get. An outcome is a pair of numbers. You know, I got, you know, six on the red die and three on the green die or something like that, assuming I can tell which die is which. But there are events, which are simply sets of possible outcomes. Right, there's the event of rolling doubles, which is mathematically represented by the set of all the pairs, you know, 1, 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4, 4, and so on. Right, so that's familiar to everybody, right? Okay, so we can adapt the same idea when we're dealing with a test space. Definition. An event of a test space or for a test space M is any subset of any test. It's just the classical idea applied test by test by test. That's all. So I want a name for the set of all events. I'm going to write script EV of script M for the set of all these events. And so if we want to if we want to be very formal about this, we would say, well, it's the collection of all the subsets of all the tests. So it's the union over the tests of their power sets. Right? And if that's not totally familiar notation, don't worry about it. It's just events are subsets of tests. So as an example, over here, that's an event. It's the event that, you know, I'm looking through chamber, from viewing chamber E, and I either see no light, or if I do see a light, it's over in chamber two, right? It's an event. Probabilities are assigned to events in the usual way. If you have an event, I'm gonna denote events typically by small letters. And the reason is that later I'm gonna wanna use capital letters as system labels. So just to avoid confusion, I'll use little letters, but toward the beginning of the alphabet for events. If A is an event, then if alpha is a state, so that's maybe in per of M, then alpha of A is the sum over the outcomes in the event of alpha of X, just as in ordinary discrete simple probability theory. So for example, in the gregarious firefly state, the probability of this event would just be the probability of chamber two, which is a half. In this state here, the probability of that event would be zero. In some mixture, it would be, let's say, half this and half this. It would be one half plus one quarter, three quarters. Okay, so that's how events work. But it turns out that there's actually a lot that's interesting that one can say about events associated with a test space. So let me start with the following idea. I'm going to say that two events. Go ahead.
The probability of this event is a definition, right?
Yes, this is a definition. Right. It's just the, but it's a familiar definition, right? It's just the usual way you calculate probabilities of
just events. Clarification. Does your definition mean any single test or any test in the set of tests?
Any test in the set of tests. So that's an event. Here is another event might be that. That's an event.
And what about Z and Y?
But Z and Y is great, not a test. It's not an event because it's not a subset of a test.
So it's any single test in your definition.
Yeah, so that's right. So it's any subset of a single test, but which test can vary. So the events are events that we can actually witness by performing an experiment. Okay, now, clearly there's kind of an issue of compatibility. We're gonna say that two events, I'm going to give you a number of terms here. So let me just call this jargon. For all tests A and B in our set of events, we say that A and B are compatible if and only if their union is still an event, which is simply another way of saying that they both live in at least one common test, right? That you can, basically, you can test them together, right? We are going to say that two events, A and B, are, and this is perhaps not the best terminology, but it is the terminology. They are orthogonal. I'm going to put that in scare quotes. And we write that in the expected way, like that, if and only if they are compatible and mutually exclusive. So their intersection is empty. So, coming over here, these two events, the orange and the green, are not compatible at all. Yes? I can't witness them together. On the other hand, these two events, let's say A and B here, those are compatible because I can witness them both by performing what was experiment E. They are not, however, mutually exclusive because I could see them both if I get outcome X. Then I would say they both had occurred. Well, an example of two orthogonal events would be, well, first of all, any two different outcomes regarded as singleton events. Also, we could do something like this. A is just seeing a light in chamber one. B is not doing that. Those are mutually exclusive. Actually, they're not just mutually exclusive. There's something more going on there. They're sort of complements of one another. So let's add yet more jargon. Continuing the jargonal list, we're going to say that A and B are, I don't like it when my chalk breaks. I really find it objectionable that chalk should break when I'm using it. I've learned through many years of teaching that it's very important to vent my frustration by throwing the chalk parallel to the blackboard and not, you know, not in any other direction. I'll tell you a funny story about that, but later. I'm going to say that our events A and B are complementary. And for that, I don't have a good notation, so I'm just going to write it like that. A co to B, if and only if they are orthogonal, but more than that, their union, which must be an event because they're compatible, is not just an event, it's an entire test. Incidentally, I should mention this, is it clear to everybody that tests themselves are events? They are, in fact, the maximal events. Okay. So, if A and B between them partition a test so that I must see A or B and never both, right? B is in some sense not A, then I say they're complementary. Okay, now we come to the thing that's really cool and sort of non-classical, something that doesn't really show up. Well, it does in a way, but not as conspicuously in classical probability theory. In a scenario like this, where there's more than one test and tests are allowed to overlap, it's perfectly possible to have two events that are not compatible, but that nevertheless have a common complement, a common complementary event. Now, in some very weak sense, when two events have a common complement, we might want to say that they're, again, in some weak sense, equivalent. The rough reasoning, and it doesn't bear a lot of weight, it's rough, is, you know, if I know that this event is going to happen, or has happened, yes, then this one didn't happen. And so presumably if I had been looking through this window, this would have happened, okay? Now, you can poke holes in that, you can drive a truck through it, and back the truck up over it, and you know, back and forth several times till it's really dead. But nevertheless, there's a little germ of something there, and we're going to seize on that and turn this idea into a very useful technical tool, right? So it may support a little bit of an interpretation, but mainly I want you to think of it as just a useful technical tool. It's the idea of what is called perspectivity. We're going to say that A and B are perspective. If and only if there exists an event C such that A is complementary to C, and C in turn is complementary to B. I'm going to write that this way. I'm just going to write A twiddle B to mean that A and B are perspective. That suggests that I have in mind some sort of an equivalence relation. It's not hard to come up with little Grigi diagrams to illustrate that this relation does not have to be transitive in general, which is another weakness to the proposed, you know, interpretation of these events as physically equivalent in some sense. Nevertheless, that is sort of beguiling. Let me mention a couple of things about perspectivity, and then we will put it to use a little bit. The first thing to note about perspectivity is that if two events are perspective, then they are equiprobable for every probability weight. The probability of A is equal to the probability of B. Let me just pause for a moment. Does everybody see why that is? Yes, the way we've defined probabilities, the probability of this is the sum of the probabilities of, say, 3 and Z. That's 1 minus the probability of 1, which in turn is 1 minus the sum of these probabilities. So these guys have the same probability. Yes? Okay. So if nothing else, perspectivity is useful because it gives you a sufficient condition for equiprobability of events, and thus also, you can recognize that two events are not perspective without even looking at the Grigi diagram if you know that they're not equiprobable. Okay, another thing to notice, as I said, is that although it's pretty clear this is a symmetric relation, right? Not generally transitive. Is it clear that it's reflexive? Everything is twiddle to itself? Just pick any complementary event. Another thing that's worth noticing is that every test is equivalent to every other test. Because nobody says that events have to be non-empty. The empty event is a perfectly good event. It's compatible with all the other events, and it's also complementary to every test. And so it can serve as the C down here. Okay. The following is slightly digressive, but I want to fit this in, especially because we might come back to it. Definition: a test space script M is algebraic if and only if it has this property, or rather its set of events has this property. For every triple of events A, B, and C, if A is perspective to B and B is complementary to C, then A is complementary to C. In other words, two events are perspective if they have a common complement. In an algebraic test space, whenever that happens, they have exactly the same common complements. Yes? All right. Now, there's a great deal to say about algebraic test spaces, and I don't propose to say very much about them except the following. This is a really good exercise to try. If you like this sort of stuff, and it's a good exercise to avoid if you don't. But with a little work, it's a little tricky the first time you try it. One can show that if M is algebraic, then twiddle is an equivalence relation on the set of events.
Can you say why that might not, why something might not be algebraic?
It's a great question. So let me address that in with three remarks. I'll try to restrain myself from writing anything on the board here. Remark one, actually every single example that I have yet shown you, the Hilbert space example, the measure theoretic example, this Firefly box example, all the other little Ricci diagrams I drew last time, they all happen to be algebraic. It does sort of seem, just as a matter of lived experience, that most of the test spaces that come up naturally are algebraic. You can, however, second remark, you can draw little Ricci diagrams of test spaces that are not. In fact, if you'll permit me, I'll draw what I sometimes call a fat Ricci diagram, in which these big nodes represent actually, you know, probably multiple outcomes, so they are events rather than minimal outcomes. This line here means these are disjoint, just as in a Ricci diagram, and add up to a test. So these are complementary events. So if I just fit some outcomes to these circles, now I've got three tests. This is twiddle to this, right? Which is complementary to this, but these aren't complementary. Now, you could say, okay, well, in that case, why not just make that a test? Just fix it. You can do that, mostly. There are some pathological cases where you can't, but you can prove a little theorem, for instance, that says if every outcome has probability greater than a half in at least one state, right? If there's at least one state in which your outcome has probability bigger than a half for every outcome, then you can always carry through this process of adding tests if you need to kind of minimally complete your test space to make it algebraic. So it's not a super, super strong condition in that way. Okay, so you get an equivalence relation on the events. That may give us a little bit more faith that perspectivity maybe captures some kind of notion of equivalence that's useful, if it's actually an equivalence relation. The other thing it makes you want to do is the thing you want to do every single time you ever encounter an equivalence relation, right? Anytime you encounter an equivalence relation, there's one thing that you immediately burn to do, which is to factor it out. Yes? So what do we get if we factor it out? Well, definition, if script M is algebraic, its so-called logic is denoted this way, by the way, happy pi day, big pi of m, is the thing you get when you take the events and you factor out twiddle. All right, that's not a very satisfactory answer yet. I've just given it a name. What can we say about this? Well, it turns out that this has an interesting structure. This is an example of what's called an orthoalgebra. Just out of curiosity, how many people here have encountered that word before? Like two. Okay, that's fine. So I'll tell you what an orthoalgebra is. So another definition. An orthoalgebra is a structure consisting of a set L, which is going to be this eventually, a binary operation, which I will write as perp, orthogonality, a partially defined binary operation, defined only on orthogonal pairs, and two elements, 0 and 1, satisfying some axioms. And I'll even write them down. I think I can do it from memory. The first is that this relation is symmetric. I won't even write that part down. It's a symmetric relation. It's also irreflexive, meaning nothing is perp to itself. Okay, behaves like orthogonality. As I say, this is technically a map from orthogonal pairs back to L. And the axioms are that it's commutative wherever it's defined. Let's say little a is in L. So if a is perp to b, then a circle plus b equals b circle plus a. It's also associative in a strong sense, which you have to be careful with partially defined operations, but it means this. If a is orthogonal to b circle plus c, and in writing that I'm assuming b and c are orthogonal, then A is orthogonal to B, A circle plus B is orthogonal to C, and A circle plus quantity B circle plus C is equal to A circle plus B circle plus C. So basically, if either side of this equation makes sense, the other side makes sense, and they are equal. Third, for every A, there exists a unique element, which I'll call A prime. I can give it a name because it's unique, such that A and A prime are orthogonal, and their sum is this special object, 1. And I think the final axiom is that for every A, if A is orthogonal to itself, then it is 0. And from those, you can prove lots and lots of other things. This is a perfectly nice structure. One of the things you can prove is that it is partially ordered. You define for all elements in your orthoalgebra L, you define A to be less than or equal to B, if and only if there exists some element C with A orthogonal to C and A circle plus C equals B. B is bigger than A if I can add something to A to make B. All right? So it's a certain kind of partial commutative semigroup. You can actually show that zero acts as a unit, so it's actually a monoid. And you can go from there if you like that sort of algebra. Okay, the fact, which I will sort of mention in passing, I really don't want to spend a lot of time on that, is that, and if you have never seen these terms before, do not fret, any orthomodular lattice or poset is an orthoalgebra, OA for orthoalgebra. How many people have heard words like this? Orthomodular, lattice maybe? Like a few more people just. Back in the 70s and 80s, these things were the prevailing models for what mathematicians called quantum logics. There was a decent literature on the subject. It was even fashionable for a while. It turns out that all of those structures are special cases of an orthoalgebra. Now, I claim that this is an orthoalgebra. Why? How? Well, this is also stuff you can check on your own. You can just do it yourself. In other words, it's an exercise. For events A and B, now these are just events, but still in the context of an algebraic test space. I'm going to write bracket A for the equivalence class of A with respect to perspectivity. In other words, it's an element of the so-called logic of M. Then you can show that these relations and operations are well defined. I'm going to say equivalence class of A is orthogonal to equivalence class of B if and only if A is orthogonal to B. I claim that's well defined. In other words, if A is perspective to A prime and A is orthogonal to B, then A prime is orthogonal to B. That's what it would mean to be well defined. Also, in this case, I claim I can define equivalence class of A circle plus equivalence class of B to be the equivalence class of A union B. The claim is that these are well defined. I can also define zero to be the equivalence class of the empty event, and one to be the equivalence class of any test. We said the tests were all equivalent to one another, so they form one big equivalence class in the logic. And then you can check that all of these axioms are satisfied. So yeah, the logic is an orthoalgebra in a natural way. In fact, it was by looking at logics of algebraic test spaces that orthoalgebras were invented. Can you go the other way? Yes, every orthoalgebra arises in this way. I won't go into the details, but every orthoalgebra can be built, in fact, in a canonical way from a suitable test space that you can extract from the orthoalgebra. Right? And if you're curious, just ask me and I can tell you in 2 minutes how that works. All right, I'm close to out of time, but I want, oh gosh, there's so much I want to do in so little time. I want to show you briefly, people are going to come into the room at 11, is that right? From last time, I think?
Maybe. Sometimes, yes.
Sometimes. Well, okay, can I go like 5 minutes over? Is that okay with people, if they let us? Okay. Let me show you a very simple model of a situation in which we have a probabilistic model, but we want to enrich it by allowing ourselves to make sequential measurements. And just because I have limited time now, we'll do more of this next time. Let's just talk about two-stage sequential measurements. I make a first measurement, and then I make a second measurement after that. Okay? So. I mean, I should say two-stage tests, but sometimes I'll say measurement. So two-stage measurements. So start with a test space M. Pick a test E in script M. And also pick a function. I'm going to call it big F, but it's not a test. It's a function from E, from this outcome set E, to script M. In other words, it selects for every outcome little x in E a test, which I'll write as F sub x in M. All right? So pick a test, and for each of its outcomes, select another test. Now, here is a way you can perform a two-stage measurement or test based on that data. Step one, do E. Let me write this over here. So, do E. Okay, when I do E, when I perform E, I get an outcome. Okay, if you get outcome X, do F sub X, do the prescribed second experiment. And then, if you get another outcome, let's say y from f of x, record output the ordered pair xy as the outcome of your two-stage test. That's all. It's just a branching two-stage experiment where the test you make at the second stage can depend on what you saw on the first stage, right? You can even draw a little sort of diagram like this. Maybe these are the outcomes of E. And then if you see X, you're going to perform, F sub X and get those outcomes. All right, so far so good. Not much going on there, right? That's just all very, very elementary. But where it gets perhaps more interesting is with the observation that once I know how to make two-stage tests out of the tests in M, well, I can gather them all together and call that a new test space. Definition. M followed by M with a little harpoon or arrow over the top is the collection of all of these two-stage tests, or rather of their outcome sets, since that's how we're representing collections of experiments. So what is the outcome set over here? Let's think about that before I finish what I just started writing. The outcomes are ordered pairs, little x and y. Little x has to come from E, and then I can follow that with anything from f sub x. So I guess I just have the union over all the x's in E of singleton x Cartesian product with set f sub x. So that's the typical form of an outcome set for a two-stage experiment. And so we want to look at the set of all of those. Okay. Little bit of, incidentally, I won't write this. This is called the forward product of M with itself. Also a little comment. There's nothing in this recipe that would prevent my using a different test space at the second stage. You could always say I have this one collection for the first stage and a different, you know, manual of possible, you know, allowed things for the second stage. That you can do. This notation becomes a little bit cumbersome, so I'm going to use an abbreviation or an abbreviated notation. I'm going to write this set just as x, f sub x, like that. Right? Is that okay with people if I do that? It's just the set of ordered pairs x followed by something in f sub x. It's just this, but I'm just writing it that way to be fast and sloppy. Okay. Now, here's a cool thing about sequential tests. If you have more than one test to play with. Let's suppose that E and F, possibly with primes, are all tests in M. For every outcome little x in, and every outcome little y, I don't know why I could reuse them, but for any outcome, say x and y, in the union of M, total outcome set, I claim that these events are perspective. X followed by E and x followed by F. Those are perspective. They have the same probability in every state. Yes? I claim these are not perspective. Right? Time is very short. I will show you why not next time. All right? But for now, treat this as an exercise to convince yourself that that is the case. Let me finish with something that will be very useful, but also is kind of a clue to what's going on there. Let's talk about what the probability weights are on this forward product, the set of two-stage tests. Well, let's say little omega is such a probability weight. Since outcomes of the forward product are actually ordered pairs of outcomes, I can think of it as a function of two variables, x and y, first outcome, second outcome. And because these guys are perspective, it follows that if I sum this over all of the outcomes little y in some test f, or if I sum it over all the, I don't know, I'm in Canada, so I should say z's, never mind, all the z's in f prime. In other words, if I try to form, we could call it the marginal probability of x, in two different ways?
There is no C in the...
No, there isn't. That's a good point. Thank you. Yes, okay. Yes. These are the same. They don't depend on F or F prime, because this is, after all, the probability of the event X F. This is the probability of the event X F prime, F prime, and they are the same according to my twiddle claim over there. Okay, so that means, therefore, that omega of X fill in the blank, right? The function of Y you get by choosing and holding X fixed adds up to the same, it's a positive number, and it adds up to the same thing over every test. If it added up to 1, that would be a probability weight. But if it adds up to something else, that's okay. It's still going to be some multiple of some probability weight that I guess depends upon little x. Okay? And this multiplying factor, that will also depend upon x, because x is fixed here. So not, let me not call it r, let me call it maybe alpha of x. And it's pretty easy to check that alpha of x is going to have to add up to 1, right, for a fixed y. So in fact, this is the form that all of the probability weights take. All probability weights, I like to use this notation, this is sort of my personal notation for this. All probability weights come about this way. You pick an alpha, a probability weight on M, and then you also pick a function, beta, which is a function from outcomes to probability weights. Right? It's giving you beta x for every x. So beta is a function from x to probability weights on M. And then you define a function of xy, which I indicate with this semicolon here, just by that formula over there. It's alpha x beta sub x of y. And that defines a probability weight on M's forward product with itself. And all the probability weights arise that way. So in fact, the set of probability weights is, as a convex set, isomorphic to the probability weights on M cross the convex set of functions from X to the probability weights, which is basically a huge Cartesian product of that, so a Cartesian power. All right, so that's what you have. Okay, so it's very big. It gets very big very quickly. Notice that there are no constraints on this function. Right? Could be anything you like. If we go back to think about the quantum model the other day, I mentioned Gleason's theorem. The model, at least if the dimension is bigger than 2, is so tightly constrained by the combinatorics of the, you know, intersecting family of orthonormal bases that the weights are just the density operators. There's nothing else, no room for anything else. Nothing prevents us from considering that frame test space forward producted with itself. You look at the collection of all the two-stage quantum experiments we could perform according to the recipe I gave you. That's a perfectly good test space. What are its probability weights? Well, they would consist of a density operator and a completely arbitrary function from the unit sphere of the Hilbert space to density operators. That's not a density operator on anything. That's just a mess. Yes? So as soon as you perform that one simple computation, that one simple construction, you've actually, in some sense, left quantum mechanics. Or at least you've put yourself in an environment that is, that includes a lot of things that are perhaps pathological from the point of view of quantum mechanics. So you could always say, well, fine, I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to constrain my state space and throw out anything that doesn't fit. But it's interesting and a little bit thought-provoking, I find, just to consider how, you know, how a very elementary operational construction at least takes you to an environment in which you have the freedom to move outside of quantum mechanics. All right, that's it for now. What I'll do next time is to say more about these two-stage and generally multi-stage experiments. There's some interesting stuff to say about that. And then I want to talk about linearization, how you make all of this linear. But to set the stage for that, one quick thing. The form of these probability weights should make it clear after a little reflection that just as perspectivity sort of breaks down a little bit in this context, ditto for equiprobability. You could have a situation where you have two events that are equiprobable if you're doing one-stage experiments, but are no longer equiprobable if you sort of condition on the results of, if you use them to precondition something else. So, you know, equiprobability also is a little suspect. Linearization, as you'll see, depends on identifying equiprobable things, and this will temper our enthusiasm for it. It's linearization is extremely useful, but it does limit our point of view a little bit.